the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire, and I'm joined here today by our very special guest, Simon Shaw, founder and CEO of 50.
Yeah, welcome. Well, look, thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you guys. I feel I'm in sort of, you know, ExchangeWire royalty, sat here in your office, despite the slightly creaky elevator on the way up. But yeah, no, we're glad to be here.
Yeah, I mean, we have moved into...
Why do you take the stairs? There's only one flight of stairs.
I electric scooted in, so yeah, I probably do need to work on fitness.
To get those steps up. Well, to be honest, Simon, this is a significantly nicer office than the one we had about 6 months ago. So, you know...
Sorry. the office
okay,
is very
we're
nice.
Not offended.
It's a great location.
And, of course, as you will have already heard, listeners, joining us in the third hot seat for the MadTech Podcast today, Kieran O'Kane, ExchangeWire's CSO. Hi there, Kieran.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yep.
I'm delighted to be here again. Once every 6 months.
Kieran's upset that we're not inviting him often enough to the podcast. So this is a special day indeed. All right, let's crack on with the first news story that I wanted to chat through with the two of you. So this is a news story based on some research that has come from Incisive, focusing on the retail industry and the degree to which retailers are digitizing their businesses. The research in particular found that less than 50% of the retailers surveyed felt that they were adequately equipped to digitise their businesses over the coming 12 months. There are specific sort of pain points that they addressed in this research when it comes to digital transformation, and those are around fulfilling product returns, increasing their digital stock and how they're handling that digital stock management and flow, and also growing digital orders that are becoming fulfilled in an in-store environment. So this feels very much like a story of post-pandemic online shopping world. So we're talking here about retailers that have had to up their game during the pandemic as a result of increased demands. So they were obviously trying to expand their e-commerce and online retail offerings and trying to handle the operational elements of that, along the way. Now we're moving to an environment where perhaps consumption in an online environment has reduced a little bit, and these retailers are now grappling with the operational elements of how they make sure that their e-commerce offering, together with the technology tools that they're using to support that e-com offering, are operating smoothly. And it feels as though, you know, a few other points that came through the research are that, you know, retailers just still feel as though the tech tools and solutions that they've got are good, but they're not fully integrated. They're not entirely sure how they're working, and they're really struggling to manage the interface between that commerce layer and that execution layer, order fulfillment and, you know, last mile delivery still being some of the biggest challenges facing them. So my question, and I'm going to come to you first on this, Simon, is what do you think retailers should be doing in order to prepare themselves for this sort of next phase of digital consumption? Bearing in mind that, you know, we're entering into very uncertain financial times, and I'm imagining all retailers are competing very heavily for shoppers' dollars. So what do you think online retailers need to be doing to make sure they're getting best attention from shoppers?
There's a lot in that question. I mean, for me at least, you know, we're talking about a challenge here of complexity. You know, there are we already in that. I was quite surprised actually that the statistics, the percentages of people that felt they were challenged were roughly uniform across all of those different statistics that got picked up on. You know, 41%, 40%, 39% across those fulfillment and then execution layers that we're kind of talking about. And I think, you know, just across that step alone, we're talking about different platforms that those brands and retailers had to be working across, and you know, different technologies. And I think, you know, we've seen a massive transition in orders. I mean, we work with lots of different brands, and huge change in, you know, really that the cost of sale, the cost of fulfillment, really driving huge changes in the market of really who's doing well and who's doing not. And I think it's a really challenging time. You know, probably the most challenging that I've seen in the time that I've been involved. But, you know, I suppose to come back to what do I think they need to do, for me, this is I think we're in such changing times that actually this is a question of agility. I think it's about actually trying to do things that are that can be immediate. This isn't time to try to make huge adapt, you know, make really big steps to implement big new systems or to solve with big sweeping. I think the time will come for that as things stabilize. Mm-hmm. I think for me, this is about agility, and it's about trying to do things that solve the problems that are right in front of us. Mm. You know, over this next 6 to 9 month period, and you know, that would be the recommendation we'd have. Yeah. In terms of particularly the order fulfillment and all of the different things like make it work, keep it working. You know, where you have opportunity, go for it. Where you don't, row back and live to fight another day.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess what you're effectively talking about here is, you know, a lot of these retailers will have been dealing with order fulfillment, stock management, sort of, you know, product diversification, all of those sorts of things are sort of day-to-day, you know, activities and day-to-day challenges for a lot of these businesses. They'll have no doubt learnt a lot during the period of the pandemic as they were having to scale up. So like you say, the focus perhaps needs to be, for now anyway, on refining those efforts, because those are the things presumably that are going to connect to the customer at the end of the day. You know, whether I buy product A from you or another online retailer is going to be about the experience that I'm having as a consumer, and that in an online environment comes down to order fulfillment, return capability, all of that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Understanding customer is, you know, certainly at the core of a lot of what we bring to the table in that area, and trying to understand, you know, incrementally, you know, who have been those new customers that arrived over COVID. We've seen a massive rise of what I call almost like what started as lockdown specialists, and then, you know, obviously sort of really capitalizing on the wave of change of behavior. And, you know, we've across the start of this year, we've seen the sort of collapse of both initially, though, were those lockdown specialists, you know, premium product through the door, when now you could go out and consume premium product if you wanted to on your feet, you
in
know,
person, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, initially we saw businesses of that type start to fall away. And then there was the challenges around cost of living and various other elements, you know, changing consumer behavior in a more general context, sort of pressurizing D2C retailers and that channel, frankly, the cost of fulfillment across fuel and the sort of pressures on the economy in getting the product into the country, all those sorts of challenges, yeah. If you like, have caused the sort of, you know, it's been huge change just across this year in who's been doing well and who's not. And so for us, it's understanding which customers are buying what and bringing that piece to the table is, I think, key. And then you can start to understand what's actually happening in these changes, because we've seen also costs of advertising change, you know, quite considerably over these periods. And I think it's just understanding who you're selling what to, you know, what, and then trying to understand what you need to do to try and sort of engage and retain, find more of customers that are spending, that are there, and then doubling down where there are wins.
Yep. Ciaran, I know the world of commerce media and retail media is one of your favourite topics. This isn't necessarily a story about that, but you're always quite opinionated on what retailers need to be doing from a tech point of view to reach their customers and to maximise their commerce offerings.
I always like to bring everything back to ad tech. I'm a mad tech, but just looking at this is an interesting sort of overview of the growing pains of like the push from analog to digital, right? So consumer behavior is forever changed in many ways. People are comfortable buying groceries online, from the Gen Zers all up until the silver surfers. People feel it's okay to do that. So what we're seeing here is the sort of the growing pains of making that experience work. So remember that the goal of a retailer is to sell more product, right? So they're there to shift product. So UX is important. I just highlighted a few things. It's funny that 39% of retailers surveyed are concerned about current store fulfillment platform, right? They feel it's insufficient. That's like, you know, the back end analytics, you know, making sure that the order goes to the warehouse, it's delivered out and people feel happy about it, right? But the things I kind of highlighted here, 40% lack confidence in their personalization platform. That's effectively search, right? Mm-hmm. One person said that the first thing that most retailers are looking at is the search function on the site, and there's a couple of like specific vendors doing that. The 42% are concerned with product catalog. That goes back to sort of like the type of like ad tech companies trying to get into that space, the Citrus Ads, excuse me, the Criteos of the world are kind of, I know that's all about ads, but a lot of that is about shifting product as well. And finally, you know, you got your content management system, which again is a MarTech piece, right? It's that back end system that manages all the sort of a product detail, the images, the media, all that kind of stuff. And I think this is sort of like an evolution, right? I wouldn't say this is a, it should be a panic for retailers. It's just a means of them to thinking from the analog to the digital. And I'll kind of flip it back into like the retail media, commerce media piece, because this has a huge importance. Talking to people who are on at the coalface, a lot of the opportunity for the trade budgets, for instance, right, which are now coming online as well, is that the experience is all about native, right? It's a very much a native experience. So that's probably why you're going to see the likes of, you know, companies like Kevil who build bespoke stuff and others doing well in that instance. So it's all, they need to kind of be wary of the consumer experience online, right? Not to overstuff with ads. It's got to be seamless. And this feels to me just companies getting the grips. And I think they will. I mean, they have. I mean, they're doing a fairly decent stab at it so far. I mean, it's probably been filled with a lot of problems here, there and everywhere. But majority of people seem pretty happy to buy groceries online and get it delivered, and seems to be working well. So I think this will evolve. I think what you have here is the growing pains of that shift from analog to digital. And I'm quite excited to see what happens next, particularly around, you know, the trade budgets coming online, because that fits into our world quite neatly.
Mm. And also, I mean, I suppose that links a little bit to what you were saying earlier as well, Simon, that from a tech perspective, what we're not looking at here necessarily is enormous issues that are going to require retailers to go right back to the start, completely assess their technology capabilities, get something brand new in that they've never used before. What we're talking about is a bit of an iterative process of getting more comfortable with some of these tech solutions and tools, which hitherto, you know, along the lines of some of the things Kieran's mentioned, have been thought of as ad tech tools, specifically ad tech tools, but actually they're going to be really important in, you know, in the sort of technology arsenal for the average retailer, right?
Yeah, look, I think tech is good. Solve. You've got to understand that, you know, in a pre sort of digital or technology led environment, these processes would have been handled by people, and you know, technology is a great replacer for aspects of managing those flows and those pipelines. Until, you know, what tech can maybe not, you know, where humans need to get involved is potentially in the troubleshooting. Mm. And I guess where you've got a bitty supply path for your product, or there's a challenge or whatever, however that pops up, you know, tech isn't going to necessarily get on the phone and bang on the guy's factory door and really speed up those pain points, if you like. So, you know, in a world where everything's a bit bitty, you've got to make sure it happens. You've still got to, you know, run an effective business, make sure you've got product so that you can sell it to the right people, understanding who's buying what products. And in some ways, the more dynamic a system is, the more you need to be really live to, like, who's buying the product now? Like, where are new customers coming from now? Yeah. Who are they? What do they care about? And being on top of those changing statistics, because we're not living right now through a period that's just, you know, what's the next quarter look like? It's just not exactly the same as what it was the year before that, you know. And tech is good at managing the steady state. It you know, you need to get involved where there's change.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that the report also highlighted is that, you know, a lot of retailers that were surveyed had said that what they were focusing on, obviously during the pandemic, was just, you know, dealing with demand, and that meant that they naturally neglected their kind of content strategies. Now they're in an environment where they're trying to refine that customer experience, because not only are they looking for customers in new places, they're also concerned about who is actually going to be spending in a slightly financially unstable environment. Where's the money going to come from, and how do they find those customers? What does their content management strategy look like as a result? And that becomes a whole advertising and marketing piece, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It comes down to like the UX and the experience on the website, and then the experience of the delivery, etc. Like that whole, you can't divorce that whole process, the logistics and the actual buying process itself. But then, you know, if the supermarkets or retailers are looking for incremental spend, they need to be clever about how they, to your point, message to people. So I'm coming around to the conclusion that a lot of the big retailer sites will not have standardized IAB units, will not have like, there'll be no video. It will be very native, it'll be seamless. And I think that UX will be weaved. And then, of course, there's a whole data piece behind that. It won't necessarily, you know, you'll be looking at first party data and search data and being able to put that together and social data and put that together to help sort of like deliver, you know, the ability to get incremental spend. Because obviously, if you're on Sainsbury buying some baked beans, you might want some bread or some sausages, but you don't really know that. But like, there is a way to sort of like, you know, market that to a user in a way that they feel that that's part of this process rather than a feckin' a pre-roll towards a, you know, the happy pig before it's slaughtered for sausages. That's a terrible story. That's why I'm not in the store brand building here.
I don't really know exactly.
But you see,
you're
what
not
I mean?
Going to get a job at a creative agency.
I think this is good. It's an evolution, and I don't think like the retailers are getting it wrong. I just think it's a massive undertaking, especially when you've got this shift in behavior. You're playing catch up, but I don't think they're like a million miles away from making this work. But this kind of fits into your point around mad tech piece, where does like, you know, data and where does the sort of ad execution and the retail media piece come into play, like product catalog, back end. It's not just, you know, it's an evolution process. And that's why I find the retail media, commerce media sort of, you know, story very interesting.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's fascinating. And I suspect you'd see similar statistics across you know, our side of that fence in that advertising space as well. I think, you know, we are seeing increased sort of fragmentation of all the things that you need to be doing. It's becoming more challenging to execute across, you know, all the different media channels and platforms that you need to be kind of present. You need to be, in order to drive revenue and growth, you need to be functioning across, you know, buying, advertising, engaging customers in the right environments. And, you know, that is becoming, it's a bigger and bigger task for retailers to get across, you know. And, you know, I think, you know, the scale of that challenge to be good at that is a big challenge. And I think we, you know, we'll see a rise in sort of specialist consultancies and support that help take and hold retailers' hands across this digital burden that is being placed on them, frankly.
And just come back to our thing, though. You think about, you know, think about what Walmart has made in terms of like ad spend last year, right? $2.1 billion. I know Walmart are absolutely massive, but they haven't maintained their trade spend in the stores. And this is iterative. Like, so if you take it to the next step, particularly for the people who are listening to this pod, is that, you know, once the retailer sort out the core competencies, which is basically joining the front end, buying experience to the back end delivery and analytics and last mile, etc. The next step is how do you then, you know, sort of get more revenue? Because you think about any kind of iterative spend on trade or retail media ads is just money to the bottom line. It's pure profit for the Tesco's and Sainsbury's, and they're not going to give that up. And that's probably the most exciting part of this. This feels to me they're getting their shit together, right? And the next stage will be
precursor.
And it will be something really exciting. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be DSPs, SSPs serving ads into retail media. I don't think that's going to happen. What it'll be is like taking clever data assets that you guys do and integrating with first party data and being able to kind of deliver a seamless ad experience or marketing experience that doesn't feel like you're being sold to.
Yeah, I think data can answer, you know, a lot of the output from the 50 platform or other data providers of, you know, in this space. It's about understanding quite often macro trends in data. You know, like 40% of your customers are this type of person and they're engaged in this type of thing. So should we then try to engage them, do this, 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 and this. And it's like, it's quite often a kind of big left or a right turn. It's a 180 one way to another. It's learning relatively substantial and obvious things that can inform, you know, media buy across a range of areas. And, you know, trade media, as Kieran was just alluding to, yeah, it's a sort of another exciting area. And it's, you know, focusing on selling stuff, getting stuff done. But, you know, you've got to be engaging the right people in the right places. You know, to be that transactional, it matters where you point those things, or else you're just buying ad impressions.
Interesting that you mentioned data. Let's move on to story number two, which is the UK government pausing the introduction of their data reform bill. Now, this is a piece of legislation that was set to replace GDPR, which, of course, is a piece of legislation that effectively, in theory, no longer applies in the UK now that we're not part of the European Union. So this is the government's attempt to replace that legislation with something that's enshrined and has been suitably debated in Parliament here in the UK that covers all areas of data protection. Now, this data reform bill, which was tabled by previous bunch of ministers, I'm just going to call them the previous bunch of ministers because they change every 5 minutes anyway, is on pause for the moment and set to be replaced by something that will allegedly, according to the Secretary of State for Digital, will focus on the important consumer privacy and data privacy and control element that we've already got in GDPR, but is supposed to be designed to be business friendly and is supposed to be less, I suppose, bogged down with red tape and is set to enable the sort of data sharing environment that businesses want to operate in to, you know, to be able to do that in a way that's legislatively compliant. What's interesting, though, about this article is that it provides no detail at all about what this particular bill might look like, what changes this particular fresh group of ministers are looking at implementing. And the really important element here is that any changes that are made to any legislation that's set to replace GDPR have got to retain in them something that's known as UK's data adequacy status. So this is a particular status that the UK has enabled to, in order to allow a free flow of data between EU businesses and companies and UK businesses and companies. And the reason that data can flow freely is because the current legislative controls in place here in the UK meet the same standards as GDPR.
We've enshrined exactly the entire legislation of GDPR into British law, so that's worth noting.
Indeed. So the argument is anything that seeks to replace that has still got to meet that same level of data adequacy, control and status. So which direction is this going to go off in? Some experts therefore don't expect to see significant changes from a legislative point of view because of data adequacy and also because there is a lot of focus on the need to ensure consumer control and data protection and privacy. So I suppose one could argue what's wrong with GDPR at the moment that really needs changing. So my question to the two of you is, where do you think this piece of legislation is going to go? Is the government going to make some significant changes? If you wanted to see some changes to GDPR legislation as it currently stands, what would those be? Ciarán, over to you first.
I don't know.
I can see you're intensely excited about conversation.
This is just another example of post-Brexit banana legislation. They never liked the shape of a banana from Europe, and they're just kind of railing against anything that might smell of EU, oversight. There is a practical point of view here, to your point about, you know, the data transfer between the EU and Britain, like, can't stand alone as a separate entity in a continent. It has to have some kind of standardized data legislation that works with the EU. They just can't go, we don't like this, we don't like pop-ups, we don't like Brexit. We're like, you know, let's have another row with Europe so we can drum up the pensioners who've elected this numbskull of a PM to have a field day.
And our current Prime Minister has not been elected. I just want to...
Oh, yeah, we're elected by 80,000 coffin-dodging...
By Tory Party members.
Predominantly white English people. I've said my piece on that one. But I think once this gets to Parliament, saying our heads will prevail. I mean, legislation like this has to go through the Lords, all the rest of it. There'll be a whole process where we'll say, like, this is nonsense. There's a lot of chest beating here. Like, it's another EU sort of thing. Oh, we don't like this. And red tape. Like, what the hell does that mean anyway? Like, all I see is, like, they talk about cutting red tape. They just make things worse. Leaving the EU so that, you know, exporters have to wait 2 days at Dover so they can transport more sausages to the EU.
Really on a sausage theme today, Ciarán.
I might have sausage for lunch, actually, when I think about it. Sausage and beans. Look, it's hard to kind of, like, see this as a serious thing. It's more, I think it's more about stick out a press release, feed the, throw more red meat to the art, to the wild dogs, if you will.
Yeah, but then, I don't think there's much in the announcement. I mean, for what it's worth, I think to the you know, even sort of mid-sized brands, you know, even small brands, you know, in reality, businesses need to be considering the legislative frameworks in all the different continents in which they're doing business, right? So, you know, even if we change the regulatory framework here and simplify this out or the other, it's, you know, people are still going to have clients and customers in Europe. And, you know, any brand worth its salt that's growing and focusing on its future is, broadly speaking, going to need to comply with, you know, all CCPA and all the different, you know, regulatory frameworks that are popping up in the US and, you know, GDPR in Europe. And anything that changes here, it will be ultimately any additional or changes to different frameworks will likely just add to the burden on brands versus simplifying it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there's, you know, you could argue GDPR is a very wide piece of legislation. And I think we're quite used to thinking about it through the context of ad tech, where it has like, you know, in a digital environment where it has like having a huge, but quite specific impact. Is there an opportunity for that legislation to get kind of like toned down here, and may that provide a kind of, as a sort of head, sort of very headquartery type economy that the UK has, particularly kind of centered here in London, but also elsewhere, maybe there's some advantages and simplifications that people could kind of cross a couple of bits out and may sort of provide some sort of competitive advantage to the UK economy, maybe. You know, I wouldn't rule it out, but I don't think it's going to be substantial, because fundamentally everyone who's at any scale is having to comply with the legislative framework everywhere. You know, and you know, you don't customize what you're doing. You do the same. You look at all the different things and you make sure that any custom you get from any place, broadly speaking, you comply with all of them, because it's too hard to be. You just can't. People, we've already talked about the biggest challenge of being too many things to do. So you just go, okay, well, you know, you just comply. And I think I think it's a competitive advantage for UK businesses to have faced down GDPR and these frameworks early. It's giving us competitive advantage over US businesses that are really only just starting to get their heads around all this stuff. Certainly in ad tech, that's been a massive advantage for us trying to pop out there, because your whole business has just been built from the ground up under GDPR, and you just go, we're just, you know, our shit don't stink, it's tight, we're ready to say the right things, you know, as those pressures, which undoubtedly we're seeing a sort of transition towards greater privacy and consumer privacy in a digital sense, it's a massive advantage for businesses in the UK.
I mean, that's a really good point, though. Yeah. Okay, Kieran, you're going to counter that, but I just wanted to say on that.
No, I'm not actually, it was getting
greater. Yeah, because I can see how that would be a huge advantage in the US, because you're starting to see privacy legislation come forward. But even when we were in Asia a month ago at ATS Singapore, we had so many conversations with people about how that is just such an unregulated market in terms of data privacy and use and application of data in a general sense, but that actually they can see legislation coming towards them from other regions, other global regions, and it will ultimately all come down to, you know, various individual countries across Southeast Asia and North Asia and the appetite for which they've got to implement any of these legislative controls around data privacy. But it feels like that is going to happen eventually. And so surely it is quite good, actually, to be designing your businesses from a privacy first
if you're not doing
point
that,
of view.
If you don't do that, even from ad tech, you're finished, because it's not just legislation that's the problem, right? It's tech, right? Apple have declared war on cookies and IDs, right? And if you can't work within that ecosystem, you're already seeing that people are cramming their spend into Chrome so they can get a 30% look on the rest of the world, when you're kind of like discounting probably the most wealthy segment, who are Apple owners or iPhone owners.
And it's completely mad.
It's not mad. It's suicidal. It's harry-carry stuff. It's crazy. And you try to tell people this, but... I do feel like the industry is a bit lemming-like. They'll run the edge of the cliff. They don't know what to do. No, we'll stay with Chrome, we'll stay with Chrome. But this new release from Google is quite interesting. This VPN that's now going to be standard in the Pixel 7, which will not be able to use IPs within the actual phone itself, which will apply to Chrome as well. So, you know, look, I think that this is just sort of like political dancing. The reality is that... your point, Rachel, if you do not start from a privacy first perspective, right, and think, oh, Google won't do this to us, oh, we're okay with legislation, you know, you're going to fall over as a business. Because I think you, if you start from that position first, right, which there's very few companies, apart from yourselves and a few others, that have done that, like, that is where you should be starting your business. Like, the idea of scalable ID, scalable cookies, that's done. It's finished. I've been saying this for 2 years, and yet people are still, you know, clamoring about. Like, I see these announcements every day from, I won't name the DSP, but, like, talking about, oh, this company has joined a UDID too. Like, I'm thinking, this is nonsense. Not, but you'll probably figure out from that one statement who it is. But it's nonsense. It doesn't scale. It won't scale. Like, there's so many barriers for it to scale. Like, the other thing is that most publishers are very reluctant now to give first-party data encrypted to SSPs or DSPs because they don't want to. The next shoe to fall is going to be IP addresses. So that's the CTV kind of thing. If you're not thinking beyond this type of legacy bullshit, then you're finished as a business. You might give the ghost up, basically.
Yeah, but I think that for me, the thing doesn't get talked about enough when you're having these conversations. It's the thing that it matters to brand. Like, it comes down to becoming more fluid about how you look at measurement. You know, and, you know, lots of people, you know, we have a completely kind of like ID-free approach to understanding audiences, to targeting audiences, to executing across multiple channels, and it's all cool. But, you know, if you are targeting, you know, lots more ads at people who are using Apple devices, you know, or just you're being agnostic about where you're placing those ads across those different devices, you see drop off in measurement because you're going, you know what, it can't be tracked. So you see, and they're like, yeah, we're drinking the Kool-Aid on the targeting. Of course our customers are on Apple devices. Of course. You get to 3 or 4 quarters in, they've got to get over, you know, it's getting over that measurement hump is the challenge, because when it really comes down to it, you know, we've just got so used basically by tracking every user across all of their different environments extensively, being able to track and target and measure in those ways. And that really what we're seeing is that, you know, at its core is that, you know, I'm sure there's lots of smart new measurement technologies out there, but basically we're going to have to think about digital in different ways and try and target advertising at the right audiences and measure ultimately like incremental growth. You know, there are ways of doing it, but you've got to basically have good product. You've got to understand who you're selling it to, find more people like them, and then engage them effectively. You know, and the CPA, blah, 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 that's the thing that people need to get over.
Yeah, and Kieran's been rabbiting on about that for a long time as well, right? We've been trying to have this measurement conversation in a sort of open way.
That's the bit they don't talk about. Everyone can talk about privacy first. Everyone can talk about new ways into it, and everyone can stand up and clap. Nobody says boo to that. It's the measurement bit that people need to get over.
That is always been the crucial part, measurement. When we talk about measurement, we actually had a panel, Measurement is Everything, at ATS London, talking about measurement. And there are ways to do it. Like, you know, many agency groups have econometric teams that build bespoke attribution around all these different channels. We need to return to that. Like, this, what we're in is the dying days of the last click attribution, right? The dying days of Google's measurement being the sort of touch point for
standard.
Everything. Yeah, it's slowly dying. So what you need to do is rethink, to your point, about how you measure all these different channels, because Google does not operate everywhere, right? It's, you know, it doesn't have a massive foothold in TV. It doesn't have a massive foothold in audio. It's got search, it's got YouTube, which are and most of the open web, but that's not everything, right? It's not in the app world, right? Certainly isn't in the Apple world. So it doesn't have a footprint. So you can't use that to model out your entire measurement. You've got to rethink that. So there are plenty of options like attention, you know, panel-based stuff, clever sort of targeting. Or more nuanced measurement, particularly around these other channels.
But it's modeling, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the that's modeling really, is huge.
I was going to say, would you add something to that,
well,
Simon?
You can't
because you're
use
talking
Google
about
as
fluid
your base
measurement.
Of modeling, because that's foolish. We live in a really, we live in an extremely fragmented world, and we did 4 or 5 years ago, which was a Google world, right? That was a Google world. And Apple kind of played into that with their ability to use their own ID for measurement on mobile devices. You don't have that anymore. Google's pulling the rug as well in Android. This VPN thing on their Pixel 7 is going to be a spanner in the works, right? So I think the war, like, I don't think it's laziness, it's inertia, right? It's just like, it's too difficult. You know, we want quick fire solutions. The IAB frustrates me in many ways because they keep trying to rehash the same old shit measurement piece over and over again. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, this is just the same as before. Google don't care about this stuff. They're on the way out. Like, that is definitely happening within the next 2 years. Google's ad tech business is getting spun out. Google care about high margin business, search, YouTube, cloud. They don't care about low margin and privacy constraints and anti-competitive constraints. They don't want to be in that business. So as an industry, we have a responsibility to rethink this. And I feel that message is getting through. Slowly, but not fast.
It's taking its time. And anything more? You know, you said measurement needs to. We need to adopt a more fluid measurement approach.
I think it. You know, I suppose as a. You know, we work a lot in data. I'm quite technical, and I guess it comes down to, you know, moving from measurement being, you know, where we're dealing with clicks and conversions, which are, like, you know, measured by tracking people's identity and cookie bombing users, like. As we move away from that, measurement becomes like modeled. It becomes like it's sort of calculated. It's looking at scale. It's looking at growth of customer. It's looking at growth of the bottom line. And, you know, brands are actually very good at that. And actually ad tech arguably isn't. You know, brands are very good at, like, understanding and measuring, like, how many conversions they're getting on what days and what happens and monitoring consumer behavior because that's what their business is. And actually, in a way, as an industry, we've been trying to convert the brands into sort of our mechanisms of measurement.
You mean Google's, not
yeah, mm-hmm. Well, whatever, yeah. It's just sort of, you know, cookie-based, ID-based kind of models. And we're kind of going back more into what I think is an area where we almost need to be, it needs to almost be more brand and retailer-led, where we're, like, actually understanding what is going on and trying to do a good job of it. It's quite straight, it's simple at some level, but it's not, I think we sometimes see, you know, people in our industry, it's just like waving hands about how all this measurement is, all this kind of stuff. You actually understand what attention measurement is. It's, you know, it's not actually measuring attention. You know, like it's modeled. It's based on, it's almost like monitoring empirical based, is this good web design or not? You know, like that's kind of what it's doing. It's not doing, you know, we're putting these wrappers on things. And I think there are useful tools to all these different areas to contribute towards how we help brands sell more stuff, to come back to the simple task of what we're trying to do. But the measurement piece is sort of just I think is the area where we need to, whenever we're talking about GDPR and privacy, for me, that's the thing we need to be talking about, because that's where we need a change of behavior in how we report and monitor our own activity, frankly.
I mean, that's interesting. Just one of the things I thought of as you were talking through that is, if you think about brands being better at that, let's say, than ad tech, you think about the old-fashioned, you know, bricks and mortar style retail model, you know, the sorts of people that big department stores used to employ to set up their stores, to take people around and through the products before they could get up the escalator to the next floor or get to the loo or whatever, was all very deliberately crafted in order to expose them to a wider range of products in the hope that that would take their attention away, et cetera. Etc. And it's almost like trying to apply that in a bit more of a digital environment and actually thinking about how that would be designed from the point of view of the experts, the product experts that are trying to sell these products, who are the brands and the retailers.
And, right? And we live in a device-led, you know, web now, and I think we Kieran was talking earlier about the importance of UX and flow and all those sorts of things. You know, the day of being able to have a really clunky website, someone gets almost like halfway through their transaction, you know, something's like half in their basket, and then you just get to, you know, you go, okay, it doesn't matter that our UX sucks, we'll just retarget the hell out of them until they've actually bought something. Like, those, you're just not gonna, you're not gonna be able to
those
do
days,
that anymore, right?
No.
That is gonna be gone. That opportunity will be gone from you, you know, in the future. And you know, you just gotta be slick and make it easy and good. And it's really like best practice, use your own product, you know, test it, experience it. You know, and for me, a lot of this comes in an ad tech context, come down to understanding the audiences that you need to be engaging so you can engage the right people in the right places. You know, it's kind of simple, but it's like over and over again.
Repeating
there are
that.
Hundreds of places that you can serve ads, hundreds of different audiences you can engage. You need to find the right ones, figure out the best places to engage them, and then engage them effectively and then be good at the point of sale. You've got to be first class. Mm. You know, retailers know how to do that in bricks and mortar. They're way better than they ever have been in a digital environment. But like focusing on that is going to become increasingly important as well, because you're kind of going to have one crack at it to make that first impression. You're not going to be able to just cookie bond them and retarget them in the future.
Yeah. That was a fascinating conversation. Started off on GDPR, ended up on measurement. I liked it.
Yeah, we were back to retail as well.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where you always end up.
Like, back to measurement and retail. No, you're right. And that's why we had that conversation at ATS London. But listen, it's all linked. I'm moving us on to the third story. Neva, which is the ad-free, tracking-free search engine, has launched here in Europe, built by former Google and YouTube ad execs. This is a really interesting search engine that's been going in the US for a little while. It's accrued something like 600,000 monthly users, I believe. Currently, it is free to use, but will be available as a subscription contribution service down the line, and tipped to remain ad-free forever, apparently. So they claim to have built the product on the basis of some underlying principles that they believe are very important, all of which we've just talked about, really. So privacy, reasonable levels of data collection and controls that are in the hands of users, so that, you know, the search engine isn't collecting and businesses that are being discovered on the search engine aren't collecting data and holding onto it forever for no apparent reason. Putting data ownership and portability in the hands of consumers, so making sure that you have got really clear understanding of what your data is used for, you know how to control that, and you can move it to enable yourself to use other products and services. And yep, there's the four main principles. This looks, in my opinion, set to be really popular in a world where increasingly the average consumer understands a lot more about what their data is used for now than they did even, say, 12 and 24 months ago. What do you think? How popular is this search engine going to be? So, I was going to go to Simon first, but Simon's already visually handed over to Kieran first. So Go on, because we're fascinated to know.
So I would just review that number. It's 600,001. I became a customer this morning.
I did the same, actually. Yeah.
600,002.
All three of us.
Three, okay.
Ridiculous.
So we're already up. It's really good. Really, really good. I have to say, I've done a couple of searches this morning. I think that the returns are amazing. For me, this is well overdue. You can't beat Google on search in terms of their model, right? Ad funded model. You're not going to beat them. They've too much resource. It's a cash cow for them. Absolute money making machine. They're never going to change that model. What this does, it takes out all the ads, which I hate, to be honest with you. The UX on Google's search is awful. The search spam is awful. It's not a very good. It's the best of a bad lot, because the other search engines are just as bad, and they're following the same model. This has got a real chance. It's clean. I like the UX. The search is also great. And I now have it as my search thing. And I'm going, this is great. So I changed my search
default.
And I'd pay for this. So I have a problem. To be honest, I'm a big fan of Google because they do brilliant products. We exchange where I use the Google infrastructure for our email and docs. And it's fantastic for small businesses. But I feel I don't like having them having too much of my time and attention and money, basically.
I mean, yeah, Google's our biggest partner in
I'm not slagging off Google, but
yeah, when I say partner, I mean we give them money. So I mean,
yeah, we too.
It is, you know, like all our infrastructure is hosted there. The cloud products are great. We use all their email. It's great. It works well. All that stuff. Small
it's actually
business.
Brilliant.
Absolutely first class. I think, you know, where we're talking about search, I think for me this is a story of sort of life cycle, where, you know, in the early phases of the search engine, you know, coming into fruition, you know, Google's search engine performs better than any of the ones that we were kind of, that they won that war by basically having a better integrated browser and search product. It all worked well together. They just won so hands down. And I think, but, you know, early on there weren't ads, you know, or there were very few. And I think you know, what we've seen here is it's a sort of a life cycle, not perhaps dissimilar to the Facebook life cycle, where, you know, what starts off in one place, they slowly iterate and iterate and iterate the product to maximize ultimately their revenue returns, to a point where, you know, you couldn't have won this war, this product couldn't have existed 5 or 6 years ago. Now it can, but you know, the amount of ads in those search boxes, it's actually, you know, having used the product a bit in the last few days, you know, you suddenly realize how many ads are in the real search.
Actual search results. Exactly. It's all ads.
It's just, it feels you're not being abused. You know what I mean? It's like, I search for something, this is what I'm getting back. And actually the search results are really, really good. I'm going, I prefer to use this than the other thing. Like,
so are we going to see them take market share seriously from Google as a search engine, given that it's going to be a subscription product going forward? I don't know.
So I think the subscription model, my understanding is they're approaching that through the lens of additive product. So it'll be like you'll be licensing like a password manager, like a 1Password or like associated products to this, so they're building on trust. That's one of their kind of core pillars. And you go, well, where else? If this brand isn't just using my data to do X, Y, or Z, what other associated digital services might I look to sort of trust this brand with? And I think my understanding is that and again, I'm sure they haven't decided this completely, but I think it may be that the subscriptive product will be additional services that then you go, okay, I'll pay my $5.99 for this or my whatever it is. But I'm not certain on that.
I mean, it's interesting though, because I'm just wondering how much of a viable business model that is. I mean, it sounds great, and would it generate the kind of revenue that they'll need it to generate in order to continue supporting a top quality search engine that is free to use? I love the idea of it.
So I think what they should do is it should be free for first 3-4 months to get customer acquisition, right? And I think then they limit the searches per month on specific, you have to log in or whatever. To be honest, there's probably, their addressable market's probably a couple of 100 million people. Yeah. I'd say your typical Apple user, your typical, because like the reality is I'd be very upset from a product point of view if this thing didn't get enough road to develop as a really, you know, proper utility. You know what I mean? I'd be very upset if Apple came in and bought it, because to be honest here, Apple are now in the ad business, and I would be very wary about them having specific data, search data about me, which they can use for their own ad business. I would happily pay for, this is not me taking a massive dump on ads. What I'm saying is Google cannot be trusted with people's data. They actually have too much of that data. And a company having that much power needs to be muzzled. But the only way they can monetize it is to monetize you and me, right? Via serving us ads. Think about it this way, right? You pay, what, $10 a month for the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or the FT or whatever newspaper you're affiliated to. I feel this is just as important as going to a newspaper via, because you're searching it, it's a utility, it's information access. And I have no problem if they kept that UX and didn't use my data and I had complete control over it and it wasn't being used to segment me to advertisers or to target people with political ads or whatever else goes on. And you look at the political campaign in the US, which is frightening about how much data they're using to target specific people around seats. I find that's all a little bit creepy and a little bit dystopian. So, you know, I think there is enough market. I was just looking at the numbers. Even at 100 million TAM, right, this could be 7.2 billion recurring revenue. On a 10x multiple or a 20x multiple, this business could be worth hundreds of billions, which would be a fantastic business, right?
But it's then what happens? Business. Do they just keep running and operating that as a business?
They run it like a proper business.
I think it's fair to say that it's been very heavily commoditized what you'd actually need to do to run a search engine now as well. You know, like those algorithms, the technology to understand the context of page, you know, it's an area, again, our business with 50 Aurora is very heavily involved in, is understanding pages. And actually the days that there are literally zeros fallen off the end of what it would cost to provide and return those search returns compared to a decade ago or so when we were last in kind of, you know, this, the war for all this kind of stuff. So the cost of processing has very heavily come down, I would say. They've got to keep delivering that performance because that will differentiate them, you know, being absolutely best in class in returning those results is literally table stakes in this game. But I think it's become that much more easy to deliver because you can now, off the peg, get really good kind of like AI, data science, all this kind of stuff to deliver what is best in class, you know, a capacity to understand what a page is all about. You know, that is not that difficult to do anymore.
I wonder what Google... try and take the legs out of them and offer their own subscription-based ad-free model, which is entirely possible, if this thing gets traction.
But then I'd argue, would that work? Because I just think if you're likely to pay for a search engine, then you're probably thinking about it to start with, and you're probably therefore looking for an alternative, right?
I would say you're right, actually.
Where Google have obviously got the edge and will continue to have as long as they offer a free search engine is in markets and across, you know, income brackets where people are not going to pay for that kind of stuff.
No.
And there's plenty of those. You know, there's plenty of global markets where any price point will be unaffordable.
Would you pay $72 for this?
A year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally would. But lots of people, I think, wouldn't.
Yeah, yes, I would. And certainly if I compare it to what else I pay for in a digital services environment, whether that be a Dropbox or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is I use this more than I would use Dropbox. Dropbox, I spend $9 a month.
I would be comfortable with them, to your point about add-ons, if they started doing the maps. I feel that's even more important because Google then have all that fucking data, excuse my language, all that data, the allocation data, which I feel very uncomfortable about as well.
Mm.
If they added on, which wouldn't be beyond them because I'm sure it's the same type of technology, then they'll have to sort of, to your
point. Maybe it's a partnership between a few businesses that are all starting up in their own verticals or whatever it is. But I think that sort of bolt-on model is for me how they build past, you know, that sense of value. I think we have been quite conditioned to this being something that's like the internet sort of is search in a lot of consumers' eyes. You know, that's where they go to find the stuff. And I think it's the gate, it's that portal, it's owning that portal. You know, I think Google have had the luxury of sitting at the front of that chain for basically too long based on the product they're now delivering off the back end, which is kind of riddled with ads. I think some new gateways there. I think this is almost like blowing the Pandora's box open a little bit.
It's exciting.
It is, actually. It's been very rarely, interested to see where it goes.
Very rarely you see a competitor in search like attacking the B2C model, right? You've got plenty of the B2B model, right? You've got the personalized search on retail sites, which I think there's a company called IO Product, a few others like that. But you don't get anybody in the B2C. And there is enough people out there that don't... Like, the privacy thing is a thing, right? Gen Z is way more wary about it. People like ourselves are wary about it. And, you know, there's...
But then what you're talking about is perhaps a financial model which is subsidised by people that are likely to buy the add-on products and then it's free to access for others, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, again, I'm quoting it's one of the Goliaths, but, you know, I think the beauty of Amazon's Prime login is it's multifaceted. Like, you know, you get your value from across a range of different areas. You know, Google tends to be much more on the peg with what you pay for, you know, pay this, get this. Whereas, you know, what I think's clever about the Amazon Prime login is you're like delivering stuff, watching video, listening to music. It's like so you've got kind of like multiple pillars of why you keep substantiating that. And I think that's where these guys should go.
Yeah, because it makes you less likely. Makes you less likely to cancel, basically.
If Apple dropped Google as their default search and went in with Meva and they did like a basically free version for Apple users and Apple underpin it. And then, I mean, that could happen. This changes the rules.
Why wouldn't Apple do that? I mean, I'm just trying to... it sort of feels like a bit of a no-brainer outside of having their own one.
I think Apple would probably say, well, should we build a search engine? It's too difficult. Search is like, you need to be almost focused. Google's a search business, right? First and foremost. All the rest of it is basically is add-ons, right? I think Apple could play a real... Tim Cook could sit down and say, well, Apple do pay Google a lot of money, right? But Can you imagine if they're giving away all that data to an ad competitor? Meva is not an ad competitor, and Apple are now in the ad business. And thinking, why are we giving all this important data away? Meva takes it and stores it away, but we hobble one of our biggest
competitors. Didn't you just say a moment ago that you'd be very suspicious of someone like Apple buying?
No, but I'm saying they don't get access to the data. Yes, what it is, it's part of their privacy market. Yeah,
yeah. That's really what I mean. If they buy this, they're buying something which still has its whole brand is set up on through that lens of independence. Exactly. They don't necessarily even have to buy it. They just have to
integrate
it.
That's what I'm saying. Partner. I would prefer, and that would be a really good thing for Apple, because then it's like, that's a good enough reason for me to go and, you know, become an Apple user. You know,
there we go. A little business model tip there for Timmy. Kieran likes to give.
It's great. Type of stuff is really interesting.
It's fascinating.
It makes our space even more rich than it is already. Like, you know,
I mean, that all blows the doors off everything.
Yeah. I know.
And then you're suddenly incredible. Wow, you know, then you've got Chrome. You know,
Search and Chrome
are the two pillars that underpin that entire house of cards. You know, so if you start to transform how one of those two gateways work, you completely transform the
Mozilla
landscape.
Goes to default on Meva, but then Google pays these people big money to stay in the search, right? What if that doesn't happen anymore? Mm. What if anti-competitive say, why are you, you're paying your way in here, that's illegal, you're using your monopoly. Mm. Look, it's good, it's healthy. Google make too much money from search. Did it time to spread the money around? By the way, if that money doesn't go to search, it goes to the rest of the ecosystem, right?
Which is good.
Less money for search, this is more money for us. Come on. Come on, Meva.
Right.
All the way.
Sign up to Neva, listeners. That brings us to the end of the news element of our podcast. We've got a couple of minutes remaining, Simon, just to understand a little bit. We've already talked quite a lot, actually, about what you're up to at 50. But anything you're particularly focusing on at 50 at the moment?
For us, the next wave of development, you know, I'm talking, you know, probably what the tech team are more focused on rather than necessarily like our kind of the current go-to-market is multi-channel. You know, I think we've worked really hard to build. We have a kind of for people that don't know, we have the 50 platform is really a place where people go to understand target audiences that they're both engaging to, selling to, and understand that what those people care about, like how they cluster together. And you know, it's all kind of anonymized, but it's like cloud based analysis that looks at understanding who it is that people should be understanding. That's our kind of core value add to that ad tech environment. And, you know, we've worked really hard to kind of use those kind of like social data signals to shape a contextual ad targeting product in 50 Aurora that was sort of our first kind of bridge from that insight environment into ad targeting. You know, it's all 100% ID free and contextual, and that, you know, we're really proud of that product. And, you know, we're delivering that across lots of different brands. It's, you know, business has basically doubled every year for a decade. So it's always been growing and, you know, super duper. Our next phase is trying to, because we're kind of genuinely insight led, the next phase of development is how we take that understanding of audiences and look to make, you know, what the brands need is they need to solve for fragmentation as well as for, you know, this, you know, the challenges around identity. And, you know, to take that insight and be able to go, okay, how do I have this one core sort of, you know, I suppose, source of truth about the audiences we're trying to understand and make that actionable across different environments. So we've been building out kind of the matching into Meta's ad serving environment, to match it across into TikTok's ad serving environment, to match it across into YouTube, into video, into Spotify, into those different areas. And, you know, because we're actually working with just kind of understanding and like going, you know, who are these audiences that they call, like what things do they care about? We've got, we're not sort of some sort of basket tracking retention trick at the end of the thing. We're all upstream, you know, we're kind of trying to move AI from that point of tracking and ad serving into understanding. You know, we believe audiences should be understood, not tracked. That's really the kind of the mechanics that we're working on. And yeah, trying to build a solve for fragmentation is at the core of our tech pathway, really, for the next phase.
That sounds hugely challenging, frankly. How is that going?
Because you know what, it's kind of not, because
really?
Of, you know, and we should have done it. It's because we're coming at it from again the commoditization of like deep tech has it's become a lot easier to work with really powerful technology products to solve problems. And you know, fundamentally, it's by extracting the essence of an audience, kind of contextually understanding what they care about. It's quite easy to kind of graph. Jamie was trying to explain it to the team the other day, but like, you know, if you imagine, the context of words, and you put them on kind of two axes, and then he's like, actually, there are 99 axes, but don't let that worry, you know, kind of thing. But
exactly,
it's looking at understanding, you know, basically what ends up being words, like describing what people are caring about in a moment, and going, how do we then overlay all of the like 63,000 ways in which an audience can be described in Facebook or Meta or whatever. But it's graphing context. And then, you know, you can then go and say, okay, well, this audience is your second biggest audience. It's your third by customer count. They're caring about these things. These are the pages that those things are being exhibited. But we can just as easily go, this is what the face, how those audiences could be best selected across TikTok's API, Meta's API, Spotify's API. These are the music artists they care about, whatever it is. It's just understanding. We're just plugging that understanding in an automated context into the APIs of those different platforms.
It's smart, because you've moved beyond, like when you first, like you could argue that you were dependent on the cookie model 2-3 years ago, but you've kind of evolved beyond that, right? Taking, you know, social signals that your core product was there, and then overlaying it with an understanding and contextualized environment. And that's really clever. If you think about it, that has applications across different channels. You don't need to have an ID. You don't need to have a cookie.
I mean,
I think that's a really important piece to remember. Like, that's a proper evolution of an ad tech company in the space, moving to a privacy first build and product build. And I think like that needs to be cheered from the roofs, really.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, look, the cookie thing was always a bit of a hack for us at some level. Yeah. You know, it was just trying to match IDs that exhibited the same behaviors, the same signals that we understood. You know, whereas actually now we're just using the signals themselves. You know, the contextual product is better than the cookie product.
Which is one of the things that we'd been saying for ages, right? Is that maybe contextual works better than cookie based targeting?
But you need an edge. You can't, like, there's 100,000 contextual companies.
Right. Yeah, and just understanding the context of a page is table stakes. Yeah. You could build that in an afternoon. You can use whether it's in Google's cloud services, there are algorithms and stuff that you can just pick off the peg that are absolutely best in class. Anyone that says that their technology is modeled off some algorithm
I see it all the time.
On
I've
a
seen
space
a lot.
Rocket in 1983 or something. You're
I've
like,
seen
whatever,
a lot of decks. Yeah.
Total garbage. Yeah. You know, that product won't perform as well as what you can just, you know. So just the processing stuff is not challenging anymore. It's how you apply these tools to create outcomes for brands. It's really what this is all about.
And what is the response from brands then at the moment?
Well, as I said, this is kind of in tech land still. Yeah, right. So, but you know, in a sense, it's what the business has always competed on. It's like, okay, learn something fundamental about the audience you're trying to understand, and then deliver those services. And it's probably also fair to say that I think the business is also, you know, focused in its next phase of growth of actually supporting that growth directly. So yeah, we're a deeply grounded technology-based business. But I think, you know, over this next phase of growth, we are supporting a lot of that activity ourselves. So you know, going direct to brand and actually championing and driving this change directly for them.
Yep.
You know, so it's, you know, you could call that service-led. You know, I've given up trying to put ourselves in a bucket or worry about any of that kind of stuff. It's driving outcomes for the brands or
Don't worry
the businesses
about
that we're trying to do.
There was 1.9 billion of acquisitions for managed service business by a private equity over the last 12 months. One last question.
Yeah, go.
If 50 Cent was to invest 100 million in your business, would you let him become the president?
Definitely.
There you go.
You know, I think, 50.
And you'd have to change to Fitty.
Yeah. For 100 million, he can have it. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Then Kieran would want to be vice president for coming up with the idea, doing the intro, facilitating
absolutely.
The intro.
I'd take 2% that 100 million.
Yeah, well, that's all. Yeah, we're fine. Well, let's see if you can make it happen.
Okay.
We do believe in
He's
the partnership.
He's a big listener. If you're out there, Fitty, we're here for you.
Amazing. We've run out of time. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have that discussion with both of you. Thank you, Simon, for coming into the office.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And thanks very much, Kieran.
It was fun. Thank you.
That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.